Welcome to Open Book. I'm Richard Walensky. My guest today, part two of a two-part interview with Tony Tacconi, who's the artistic director of Berkeley Rep, the third artistic director of the company. It's been around four decades, and this is the 10th year of Tony Tacconi as artistic director, formerly artistic director over at the Eureka Theater for 7 years in San Francisco. Tony Tacconi has directed several plays at Berkeley Rep, most recently and still open, Wishful Drinking, a one-woman show with Carrie Fisher. Berkeley Rep, celebrating its 40th year, has been since 1980 in its current location. The Thrust Stage, the Rota Theater, opened in 2001. Let's talk a little about the choice of plays. I was looking at this past season, a couple of one-person shows, and then next season looking at plays like Yellow Jacket, an August Wilson play, Joe Turner's Come and Gone, Arabian Nights, Mary Zimmerman, the Vibrator play by Sarah Rule, whose Dead Man's Cell Phone just opened on Broadway, a couple of imports, one from Chicago and one from off-Broadway, Lieutenant Divinishmore, which I'm looking forward to seeing myself because I love McDonough's stuff. Right. Still haven't seen In Bruges.
It's supposed to be good.
This series, right. I mean, how do you determine it? More specifically, let's look at one in particular. Yellow Jacket is done by a young playwright from Berkeley who's just past the age of 30. It was commissioned by Berkeley Rep. How does that work? How do you commission a play, and what is the process?
Edamar Moses, who's the writer, is 30 years old. He went to Berkeley High and graduated in 1992, the same year that my oldest son also graduated from Berkeley High. Edamar is a wonderful writer, and we have a new program at the Rep. We want to basically hire 50 playwrights over the next 10 years to write a play for us. So we want to introduce 50 new plays into the lexicon of American drama. That's very ambitious, and it's very exciting. Edamar and Sarah's plays, which are going to premiere next year, represent the first sort of full expression, production of that program. Even though we've done a lot of new work in the past, this is a formal program that makes the production and the development of new work an absolutely fundamental part of what we do every single year, which is really good for us and really exciting. It also creates a home for the American playwright, and which we want to be. I think in the past we've basically been a home for the director, sometimes for the actor, and not quite enough for the writer. And this is our statement, really, to sort of move in a dramatic way to accomplish that. So Edamar's play. So how do you commission a play? It's not that complicated. You identify writers who you love or who you find are promising. We have a literary staff, a dramaturg, and a literary manager. Madeline Oldham is our dramaturg. Les Waters, who's my associate, who has spent his entire life both at the Royal Court in England, developing younger writers, has a phenomenal eye and ear for new work. I've worked with a lot of folks. Amy, who's our casting associate, she's got a wonderful eye. So the entire artistic staff and some of the administrative staff is poised to be looking out for talent, feeding us new scripts. So we identify somebody who we like, we approach them, and we say, "Are you interested and available for a commission?" We then pay them money. We pay them a sum of money, and we set a date. We say, hypothetically, a year from now, you're going to hand us the first draft of a play. So, Richard, we're going to hire you to write a play. A year from now, you're going to submit it. And then you start saying, well, how about 15 months? I anticipate my dog having major surgery. So we negotiate the date, which is fine. And it's usually almost always the playwright saying, I can't quite get it in then. But whatever date that is, whenever the script comes in, within a very short amount of time, let's say a month or two, we will have a reading of that play. At which time we have the option, we own the rights, we have the option of going forward with either draft number two or the final draft. If we're going to go forward at that point, that's a pretty serious statement. It's on a track to being done. So we start to gear up for workshops. Now, playwrights need different things, and they all basically want one single thing. They want you to do their play. It's not rocket science. And so once, if you've decided that you're going to do it, and in most cases we probably will, if we decide to do it, then we will determine, we'll sort of create a strategy. What does this play need? What does the playwright need? Some playwrights like a workshop. Some hate the workshop. Some workshops are for the staff to actually learn about the play and to see what the challenges are. And some are really for the writer to just really hear what the mechanics of the play are.
And then eventually you set a date when you feel it's ready.
Yeah, yeah. And it's almost always a little bit later than what the playwright wants. I mean, you know, you're trying to err on the side of, like, making it ready, and they're trying to, like, get on with life. Because also, you know, the individual life is faster than the organizational life. So if I say to you, Richard, you know, I want to do your next play. I mean, I'm really excited about what do you want to write about? And also, by the way, we never tell anybody what to write about. Because in my experience, it's a disaster if you do. I mean, it's like saying, Richard, I want you to write about the environment. And you say, okay, how does that work with my imagination? But let's say you even say, okay, what happens is you will sit down, and in a year I will get a play most likely about an incestuous relationship between, you know, a family in the Midwest. It has nothing to do with the environment. Because, as you know, when you sit down to actually create something, your unconscious kicks in. And something else happens on the page, in your head, in your heart, in your spirit. And you got to go with that. You can't, I mean, it's different in that sense very much so than academia, you know, where you set out to write a book about the history of radio from
whatever.
You know, yeah, exactly.
How many of these commissions do you have a year, and how many plays actually wind up at the end being produced?
Well, that's a really, really good and uncomfortable question. We have about 3 to 5 a year going out on the commissions. Right now we have 11 people writing plays for us. They're all going to come in at different times because some of them are really backed up with other work. On July 1st of this year, we're supposed to get 3 scripts. I'll let you know what comes in. I mean, it's always a bit of a crapshoot, you know, in the sense of it's always interrupted or affected by real events in time, so you can't quite tell what's going to happen. But how many of them will we do? I'd say we'll do half. But we will try to marry a director of note with every playwright, and we will try to place every play somewhere.
So the playwright will work in the final stages with the director?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yes, to get the script into some kind of shape for like a final draft or a working draft that you can go, you know, like into a rehearsal hall with.
Tony Taccone, let's talk a little about your career at this point. Did you want to be an actor originally? Did you
always
want to?
All of us make that mistake, Richard. You know, most people get into theater, you know, whether it's sixth grade or high school or college, which I didn't get into theater until I was in graduate school, actually. But, yeah, sure, I was an actor for a number of years. I was really bad. I was a decent comic actor because I weighed about 85 pounds, and you put me in a pair of tights, it was an instant laugh. But other than that, my skills were limited. And actually, I was on tour as an actor in Colorado with a school tour show, and one of the directors who was scheduled to do one of the shows that we had in rep couldn't do it. At the last minute, they came and asked me if I'd be interested, and I said, sure, and I went into rehearsal the next day. And within, it's the only real time I've ever had like a real like epiphany. Like within an hour of doing it, I knew at the very least I was going to be a lot more engaged with being like a director than I was an actor.
And that's how it began for you. And where was that?
In Colorado.
In Colorado. So you started in Colorado. What point did you come to the Bay Area?
I came to the Bay Area in 1975. I was in the graduate program at Cal for a while until 79. I spent really 4 really great years there. And then I went to the Berkeley Stage Company, which is a thriving theater company, where Freight and Salvage is currently. There was a wonderful, thriving company that happened there for a number of years down there. I worked there. Then I went over to the Eureka.
Well, at the Eureka, you midwifed, I guess, Angels in America.
Yeah.
Did Kushner approach you? Did you just see a script? How did that happen?
No.
That was in L.A. originally, right?
No. Oh, no. No.
Oh, it was originally Eureka before it went to L.A.
Absolutely. But it was the full production, the world premiere production of parts 1 and 2 premiered in Los Angeles. It's a complicated story, but how it happened was Oscar Eustace, who is now running the Public Theater, a really good friend of mine, who's a dramaturg, of the Eureka when I was there. We had been searching for the new generation of American writers who were politically inclined, unafraid, and who had something to say. And we literally went on a kind of search for these people because we had been doing like the best of the Brits who had really become kind of like mentors for us. So we had heard about this kid named Tony Kushner from a professor friend who had him as a student. So I literally like dispatched Oscar to New York to go find this guy. We heard that he was in the New York City in the downtown working with a small a group of folks. He came back off the plane. He met with Tony, found him in rehearsal for a play that has never been done called Heavenly Theater, his first play. And he came back with a play in hand called A Bright Room Cold Day and said, you have to read this overnight. And I read it overnight. And he said, and I said, this is the best play I've read in 10 years. We decided to produce that play. Tony was unknown at the time. We flew him out. We worked with him. We did a production on that play, which was wildly interesting. And we thought, this guy has so much talent. It's just unbelievable.
What was that play again?
A Bright Room Cold Day.
Okay.
It was about Hitler's rise to power in the Weimar Republic, and interspersed with that were scenes from a radical Jewish younger woman who was railing about Reagan and the parallels between Reagan and Hitler. That's what it's about. So it was not for the faint-hearted. But then based upon that experience with him, we hired him to write a new play. He said the only thing he knew about it was it was going to be really short, a three-character chamber piece, and it had Roy Conan and a couple of Mormons. And 7 years later, it became Angel in America.
Did he just show up with Millennium Approaches?
No. That was a process that was. Although he wrote Millennium really fast, it came to him really, really fast. He wrote it in 9 months. He just wrote it, and it kind of was birthed out of his head. Perestroika took like 3.5 years.
Well, Perestroika, you said was the Perestroika premiere was down south then, or was
yes.
that yeah
yeah part one Millennium premiered at the Eureka, and then they read what he had of Perestroika as the sort of like addendum, if you will, to the evening. And then Millennium premiered in London after that. But then at the taper in L.A., Oscar and I did the full-bloodied version.
Well, when Millennium showed up, that was the complete play then. Or did
yes,
you?
Was.
You
it
didn't
was.
Know there'd be a part two.
No. We knew there would be a part two. We always knew there would be a part two. We always knew that. But he just hadn't written it. So, and it's just easier beginning things than ending them.
How close is the version that you worked on at Eureka with what I saw in New York and with what a lot of people saw in HBO?
Well, HBO had adaptations that Tony wrote for the movie because it's like a film is not. Like a stage version. I mean, and I will say this about the movie, which I thought was, acted brilliantly. But I think that piece is essentially a theater play. And I think that the parts of it that were less realized was the stage magic, which was particular and special on stage. Having said that, I think it's pretty close. I think both versions are pretty close. I mean, certainly the stage version in New York was the version that we did in L.A.
After you became the artistic director here at Berkeley Rep, he approached you then about Homebody Kabul?
Well, Tony and I are close, and basically he shows me what he's writing. I feel privileged to be one of the people who it's a small circle of people who he sends his ruminations. And he sent me a 250-page, single-spaced manuscript, which is probably 8 hours long. Not 8 hours, but it probably is about a 4.5-hour version long of Homebody, which was, as he would say, a mess. But I could tell immediately. The opening monologue is unbelievable. It's a just astonishing piece of writing. And I said to him, we're going to do this. I just said, look, we're going to do this.
When you say that, you have full control. I mean, you don't have to report back to anybody at Berkeley Rep and say...
Well, I do have control, but certainly I have a staff, and so I have to marry my desires to possibility and resources and time and real things. But if I believe in something really, really, really a lot, I can usually make something happen.
You're listening to an interview with Tony Taccone, who's the artistic director of Berkeley Rep. So at that point, you read Humbody Kabul, and you're floored by the opening monologue, which was astonishing.
Right, right. Yeah. And so I said, look, we're going to do this. You know, we'll work on it. And we did. We worked on it really hard. And we also, one of the things that's hard about Homebody is just the casting issues. Because, you know, there were a lot of Arab Americans in it, and just finding those people who could handle the language, who could, you know, all these things that come into play. It's not a huge acting pool. So culling the country for actors who could do it. And then it became successful. We extended it for a really long time here.
I don't remember. I don't know if it ever debuted on Broadway. I don't think
it didn't. It did. It's not it's not a Broadway show. It's too thick. There was a production of it that was done at New York Theater Workshop, which was okay. And I think based upon that, it didn't catch fire in New York.
And then came Brundibar.
I'd done Slavs before I did Homebody. But Slavs was really kind of outtakes from Perestroika. You know, it was a way to keep him in the game. And then I also did Hydrotaphia, which was another play that was written before all this stuff. And I literally produced that play in my first year as AD because Tony was suffering from writer's block. And he was thinking about giving up the theater and going into film. And he was really in. And so I said, no. That's a really bad idea. Come back to the theater. And it was great because it was important to him that we did it, and I worked on it with him, and it kept him in the game.
Well, that brings up a question, which is something when I interviewed him a couple of years ago, I didn't ask him about, which is, what happens to a playwright when their first play is one of the great plays of the 20th century? Where do you go from there?
It's not a good thing. I mean, he had writer's block for probably 5 years. Because everywhere he turned, he was the guy who wrote Angels in America. And so he suffered from, you know, the onus of that. Just the sense of, like, well, what else am I going to be able to do? How can I follow this up? Which is why Slavs was outtakes from Perestroika. Really great and enjoyable ones, but it was still outtakes from Perestroika. So he wrote a couple of scenes, but it wasn't like writing a full play. It really kind of wasn't until... I mean, really, truly, to be honest with you, it wasn't really until Caroline, which is, you know, his musical piece that is inspired by his own life, but not a piece of autobiography, but it is inspired by his own life. It wasn't until Caroline that I think he fully broke from Angels in America. And that's exciting.
And after that, he worked on Munich.
He wrote Munich. And now he's writing the new Lincoln movie for Spielberg.
Is he working on any plays these days?
Yeah. In fact, in the spring of 2009, which is coming up pretty soon, actually.
Well, for you, it's tomorrow.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Well, the Guthrie Theater in Minneapolis is going to have a Kushner Festival in the spring of 2009. And they're going to do Carolina Change. They're going to do a new Kushner play, drama. I'm going to direct An Evening of His 1X. And so we picked five of them, and it's going to be in the studio. And then I'm going to bring those back to Berkeley Rep. We'll do them in spring of 2009, at the end of the Guthrie season, and bring them back in the fall for the following year for Berkeley Rep.
When you're putting together like 2008 to 2009, I noticed that there are a couple of imports in there. I mean, how do you balance, like, Figaro, I guess, is kind of an import, right?
Yeah, Figaro is not even kind of, it is.
It is an import.
It is an import. I mean, this season has, like, too many imports for me to, I mean, just to be really honest with you, I feel like it's a little import heavy, and some of it is accidental. The reason why Carrie Fisher's in our season, it's kind of an anomaly. I mean, we really don't do that kind of work. I think as a special event, nobody would question it at all, but... You know, as a subscription package, it's a little bit more chancy because it doesn't really offer the substance of a three-act play, certainly. However, we had a play scheduled featuring Rita Moreno, who's become a colleague and a friend because she lives here, and she's a wonderful actress and a major artist and somebody who I'm so ecstatic to have on our stage. But we lost it because Rita's pilot got picked up, and we had announced it, and we were selling tickets for it. So the only way Carrie Fisher worked was because, well, we had been selling tickets to a play featuring a very, very well-known actress. And so I was kind of stuck between a rock and a hard place. I was also really against the idea of doing 2 one-person shows in the same year. I thought, this is not good. It didn't make me feel good at all.
Well, at the same time.
Yeah,
actually,
it was weird. It just feels weird. Having said that, it's worked out.
Well, for me, watching it, it's kind of, I mean, I've seen up until these plays, I've seen the sporadic Berkeley
right, exactly.
Rep play. And then suddenly, in prep for this interview, I'm suddenly seeing one person play.
Yeah. It's just an anomaly. And if you look at next year, I mean, Yellow Jackets is a cast of 12. Joe Turner's a cast of 12. Arabian Nights is a cast of 15. I mean, Sarah Rule's play, her new play, the Vibrator play, enticingly entitled the Vibrator play. You know, that's a cast of 7. I mean, we're going back to plays.
Well, for a play like Lieutenant of Inishmore, is that that's a local production, right?
Yes, it is.
Is that the kind of play that you and Carrie Perloff would kind of go, well, we both want this, I would think?
They didn't put in for Lieutenant of Inishmore.
Did they put in for the...
For the Pillow Man? I think that they did.
Yeah.
And because we got in there early and, you kind of use different relationships at that point. Although, ACT has a bigger size house, so for straight up numbers, they're going to win out over us. I mean, there is a pecking order.
Right.
So we're going to get plays that Shotgun can't get because it will give the playwright more money and give the people who own the rights more money. So there is that. You just have to, live with that. I mean, there have been plays that we wanted to do with Carol Shorenstein Hayes. I wanted to do Top Dog, Underdog. And, she had the rights to it, so she got it. And great.
What about a musical like James Joyce's The Dead, which was an import that went into ACT? If they had passed on it, would you have taken a shot?
Yeah,
like
I love
that
play.
Yeah,
I love it. I thought it was fantastic. And, I mean, I think the thing is, though, with big shows, like big musicals, are actually kind of hard to make in a 600-seat house. They're hard to make work because of the numbers. You know, what price point do you have to charge people? You know, I mean, I think that the musical, we can really pretty easily do what you might call a chamber musical.
Like Passing Strange.
Like Passing Strange. Or, yeah. Or even, we did Brindabar. That was extraordinarily, expensive, but it was worth it. I mean, we had a full orchestra. Well, we had a 13-piece orchestra, which is not a full orchestra. For a full orchestra, as you know, is, well, on Broadway, you're looking at 20, 24, 25, 26 folks.
And for a show like Passing Strange, what's that? That's just a small combo?
Passing Strange was a band of 4 and a company of 6. So, a band of 5, excuse me. So that's 11 folks. That's that's a doable thing. Although whenever you do music, you incur all kinds of challenges, that are both costly and also require a lot of attention and time because the music has to be scored and directed and arranged and shaped and teched. So it's a lot of stuff.
Tony Taccone, how important is a review by Robert Hurwitt?
It's important. It's important. Fortunately, I think Rob's a really, not only is he intelligent, I think he cares a lot about the craft. I think he cares a lot about the theater. And so we've had critics in the past at the Chronicle whose interests were decidedly different, commercial interests. And that's, I'm going way back in the day, but... But I would say, yeah, it's important. I mean, it isn't, I have to say, it's that little man thing, the little man.
I've heard that before,
We haven't done a breakdown as to exactly how much money the little man's worth. I think I prefer to stay out of that thought process. But, yeah, it's a real thing. I'm not going to say it isn't a real thing, it has an effect. Although, I mean, I'm sure certainly there are shows that have been very well reviewed, that had a hard time finding an audience that was, commensurate with the expectation of the review. And there were shows that overcame what you might perceive as a lukewarm review.
Yeah, well, that little man is an interesting case. A friend of mine was one of the stars of Staircase at Rhino. And the review was pretty clear. It could have been either a clapping or a standing, looking straight.
What the Chronicle calls the attentive man and what we call the staring man.
Well, he said that that the difference was between having packed houses and mostly empty houses.
Yeah. Well, I think it's probably a little different with the smaller, folks, because we have a lot of subscribers. So people buy seasonal passes to see numbers of shows. So, you know, they're kind of stuck with us no matter what happens. But what happens is that, you know, we'll have like a no-show rate that's higher for a show that isn't reviewed well or whatever.
And you do extend by a week or two.
We've built into our process the possibility of extending virtually every show by at least a week.
You ever bring a show back?
Oh, God. We've almost brought shows back. We talked a lot about bringing Brindabar back because the piece that we did in front of it, Tony rewrote a new play for it in New York, and it was a much better experience, so we thought about doing that. We've almost brought back, like, The Tooth of Crime a couple of times, but we haven't, and we maybe should.
Tony Ciccone, you've now been with them for 10 years. How long do you want to stay with them?
Well, I've been with Berkeley for 21 years.
Okay.
So I've been artistic director for 10. But I guess, you know, I'll be there until they kick me out, which is probably pretty soon.
And how many do you direct a year?
I usually direct two. But, like, next year I'm going to do one because Taking Over and Carrie Show are both going to go a lot on the road. So I want to pay attention to that when that happens.
Does it become a problem when someone asks you to do something and you've got your duties at Berkeley?
Oh, of course. I would never abandon my duties at Berkeley. But because I'm also going to do the Kushner thing,
right.
that makes it a little bit more precarious. So, but I am going to bring that back. So I always try to, if I'm going to work out of town, it's much better, obviously, if I can bring the work back.
And what about film? Have you ever thought of doing film?
I have thought about it, and I even seriously entertained it a couple of years ago. But one time, the rhythm of theater really suits me. I really like being able to do shows, you know, within a 8-month period of time. The idea of spending like 5 years in a movie, and basically it's like being in like technical rehearsals for like 2 years. I mean, I don't really relish that.
You've been listening to part two of a two-part interview with Tony Ciccone, artistic director of Berkeley Rep, now playing at Berkeley Rep. Tragedy, A Tragedy by Will Eno, which is open till April 13th, and Wishful Drinking with Carrie Fisher, which will be playing till April 12th. I'm Richard Walensky for Open Book.